As we do get started, may I ask, of this group, I'm interested in just three things. You know, I'm going to divide you into three groups. That doesn't mean that all of the world can be thus divided, you know. How many of you are parish pastors or have been parish pastors? How many are pastors' wives or have been pastors' wives? How many are lay members of Lutheran congregations? Okay. Anybody that doesn't fall into any of those three groups?
Director of Christian Education
at a church. Okay.
What is
seminarian? Seminarian, that's forever no man's land. That's no status at all.
Just so we get it straight.
Yeah, that's fine. And if you're a wife of a seminarian, that's even worse. Though when I was at seminary, the seminary wives at that time, that was a different generation, they were the most powerful group on campus. And I suppose if anything that I distinguished myself for in seminary, it was for standing in opposition to that group when it came to scheduling events. They were the only people that had the calendar sewed up for the year. I tried to get Martin Luther King to come to Luther Seminary, and the major problem in scheduling, as I remember, was seminary wives. I hope that isn't on tape. In order to proceed with this topic of parish ministry, its privileges and problems, it's kind of necessary that I do some introductory background to tell you, and I have to tell you more about myself in some ways than I really want to, perhaps. But of necessity, the reflections have to be kind of reflections of a personal pilgrimage, and from that kind of perspective. I will make some generalizations out of that experience, but it's not the kind of thing that grows out of having read the 10 latest books on the practice of parish ministry. There probably aren't 10 latest ones that are, you know, worth reading. But I haven't been a parish pastor terribly long. I was ordained in 1972 after 7 years of college teaching and administration, after all sorts of over-institutionalization in terms of accumulating degrees. And I'll tell you that not because you ought to do any kind of obeisance about that, but that just so you should know that, you know, I survived all that. It involved 2 years at Lutheran Bible Institute, 4 years at Concordia College, 3 years at Luther Seminary, a year at the University of Münster in Germany, and then 4 years at Yale University, accumulating an MA and a PhD. Now, that's a lot of years to spend in institutions after high school. No offense to any of my beloved former professors, one of whom is Wendell Frericks, but there was a time when he had to be under me as well. As I remember, when he came finally to the Institute for Ecumenical and Cultural Research at St. John's. Another thing that I have to say about that I'm very, very grateful to the pastors that I had, especially in those adult years from 18 to 38, that what they represented as parish pastors was significant enough that it called me out of one way of ministering to another. You know, that I have to say that I'm very, very grateful to them. Some of them were very patient with me. And, of course, sometimes I had to be rather patient with them as well. Another thing that I have to say is that perhaps the best preparation for parish ministry occurred in that period of time as a pew sitter in a congregation. I was really, with some allowances for that matter of working in the area of theology, I was an authentic pew-sitting church member for almost those entire 20 years. And one of the principles by which my wife and I lived as soon as we were married, among other things, was that if we were ever going to be in any place for 6 months, we would join a congregation. I say that as an affirmation of something, but also as a complaint against seminarians who never attach themselves to congregations, who are ordained as pastors, never having been any kind of authentic member of a parish in any of their adult years. And I also say there's a complaint against seminaries that seem in certain ways to discourage that kind of membership. Used to. I don't know what the policy is now. That was tremendously important. It always meant that we got offering envelopes. It meant that we would also be asked to teach Sunday school. We had to learn what it is to say no about some of those things. It meant that we had to own a community of people in all of their specificity. And we had to be a part of those people that took care of our children. I remember one time in a nursery, and there was a woman who I was convinced totally hated children. It meant that we had to own the pastor in a very special way, and we could not just flit from one parish to another to see who the best preachers in Minneapolis, St. Paul were, or whatever. Then another dimension of that was that in New Haven, Connecticut, there wasn't a parish of the American Lutheran Church, so we had to take up membership as associate members of a congregation of the Lutheran Church in America.
Oh.
And it was a very, very difficult thing to do. It tested our faith, tried us, but nonetheless, you see, it made us own that synod in a very special kind of way. And I think as a result, to some degree, I read the Lutheran now, I don't know whether that's good or bad. I discover that some of the worst editorials I've ever read in my life have been published in the Lutheran. But we'll talk about those some other time. There was one brief interlude that did become terribly important in my life in ways that I could have never anticipated at the time, and Jay Spoonheim will remember some of this, I think, as a student at Concordia College at the time. I happened to have been, while I was at college, the lay pastor of St. Luke's Lutheran Church on a northwest angle in Lake of the Woods, full-time for 3 summers, sometime in the winter. It was a genuine wilderness area, accessible only by boat or plane. There were among the members there fishermen, what do you call them? Commercial fishermen, lumberjacks, I think also some people in the area who were refugees from the law. It was a fantastic experience. And I learned something from them that I tried not to forget. It sometimes got me into trouble. Something about authenticity, genuineness, straight talk, honest talk, strong talk. And it gave me, I think that as I've reflected back on this, one time when my name was tossed into the hopper among many others for the presidency of one of our Lutheran colleges. And I've often reflected why I did this, and perhaps they gave me the courage to do it. When you had to list your strengths and weaknesses and some of those things, you know how those go. I remember listing that I considered one of my best qualities was the fact that I had a very good nose for BS of varying kinds, theological, ecclesiastical, educational, and that I had developed that while a young lad on a farm in North Dakota and had found it pressed into service frequently since. that has been, I think, even important, if you'd allow me to say so, in being a parish pastor. Now, what I'm going to offer by way of reflections is, for me, really an experience of trying to chart my own progress in a very conscious way against some certain kinds of mileposts. I've been trying to sort out what this is all about. Then I also want to offer it to those of you who are fellow pastors, hoping that perhaps along the way, maybe something will be brought to reflective consciousness in your lives that might have been left out. I found that I have had to operate at a much higher reflective level coming in so late. I was really very ignorant. It was tough. I had to call up my neighboring pastors and ask them how to fill out a wedding certificate. That induces considerable humility when you have to, you can't imagine the things that I had to call on my fellow pastors for. To ask them You know, I didn't really have any idea how you ran an ushering program, you know, in spite of being lame. That's the one thing I was never really asked to do. To have to call and ask about all those kinds of things really, really was kind of wonderful. And it did teach me something, though, that I was forced to operate with a higher reflective consciousness about all of my activities than those who had usually come out of seminary and gone into the parish and begun to pick up an awful lot of patterns, so that at age 40, they knew what they were about or didn't know what they were about, but it didn't make quite as much difference, perhaps. And I don't say that as any kind of put down. Then I offer these reflections also for lay people in the hope that through them maybe you will understand a little bit more about your pastor. And I'll try to say something about that, and I'll be pretty frank and blunt when you ask questions. But I've divided things into, you know, some kind of organization, so you have some notion that I've done some preparation. First kind of way to explore things is this: the call, ordination, and the leap from professorship to the parish, a quest for new identity. First thing I want to say is this: I am not just a parish pastor. I've never been just in anything. I think of one poster that hung on the hospital of St. Cloud Hospital, run by the lovely Benedictines. God made me and God don't make junk. And not only that, the things that I do, I just have really believed, maybe foolishly a long life's way, that by and large most of them are quite important. They might seem to be terribly trivial, but you know, sometimes they're just awfully important. I'm glad that mechanics feel that way when they put, you know, the wheels back in my car. If they've taken them off, they tighten all the lug nuts. One joker didn't one time when I was going to the Lutheran World Federation meeting in 1957 in Minneapolis, and could have killed all four of us, especially in a Volkswagen. I'm not just a parish pastor. But so you might appreciate what is really involved in moving from professorship to parish pastorate, just imagine this title. I was the associate director of the Institute for Ecumenical and Cultural Research and assistant professor on the graduate faculty of St. John's Abbey University. And from there, I went to Luther Crest Bible Camp with eighth graders, where they sang the Norsky Sunday School song. Now, that was not only a quantitative leap, that was a qualitative leap of enormous proportions. And the first time I heard some of those songs, my stomach, you know, my head began to spin at the theology, you know, and it affected my stomach for a couple days. It was, I began to ask myself what was really going on in this world. But I'll have to tell you in all candor, that adjustment was relatively easy to live through, even though at moments it had its pain. But there was a second thing that I encountered that was rather difficult to live through. It was something that I had not anticipated in making that move. I didn't realize that I was stepping down professionally. I knew that my salary would drop $4,500. But I really didn't have in my own view, I wasn't prepared to violate the success ladder that exists, it seems to me, in certain kinds of implicit ways in the church. The success ladder usually runs from parish ministry to professorship, or from parish ministry to specialized ministry, or from parish ministry to the central offices of the church. In our case, in Minneapolis, they don't like us to refer to it anymore as headquarters. They should be relieved, though, if we still refer to it as headquarters. I could think of some other parts of the body that might be used in that reference. But, you know, this was really rather difficult to cope with, because it was kind of foreign to anything I had been really used to in reflecting about parish ministry myself. And another success letter that I had difficulty with very quickly was that which was existed alongside of these in the minds of some of the people of the parish, that certainly I should only stay here 2 or 3 years and then be very desirous and probably even out scrounging for one of those large congregations. Now, lest you think that Atonement Lutheran Church is only 250, rest assured that we are 1,000 baptized, you know, so, but we are not Central Lutheran Church or Mount Olivet or one of those places, for which I am kind of grateful, but that's another side. The difficulty came because of the mixed signals. And I don't to this day know how to clarify all of this, but on the one hand, within the church, the parish ministry was exalted as the front lines. And then it was also exalted as the place where the action really is. But I had trouble coping with that I was going to the front lines and the place where the action really is. And then as I began to explain this change a little bit to friends and to strangers, somehow I became defensive because it always seemed as though there were some questions that were unasked, such as, couldn't you really make it in academia? Or, so you're going to parish now, Nothing much more to say. As though, are you having personal problems, or, you know, what is going on? And I found myself then with this obligation after a while. I developed an obligation to go through a little litany of kind of justifying, you know, and protesting too much, because I began to anticipate what those questions might be. I'm sure some of you have been in some of those situations, so you understand what... But that's an ambiguity that I think exists very strongly in the church. And it takes its toll on parish pastors. I don't know what shape it's going to take. It is, if only somebody had been just terribly blunt about that, you know, and said something, oh, you dumb jerk, don't you know that you've really stepped down now? But I always had to wrestle with a certain kind of ambiguity, and still to this day, though now any of the emotional trauma of it, I think, is totally over. Then I also found myself in the midst of a church where many clergy seemed at times kind of insecure, it seemed to me, about precisely the validity and the high quality of their calling. A lot of questions being asked about that. And I'm going to offer some explanations as to why I think some of that happened. Some of it is related to that matter of how you move up and that success ladder that is imposed. Then I found that struggle to become kind of intense at times, because it was a struggle really between success and discipleship. Success and discipleship. What really constitutes success in life at all, at any level? And how do you enter into the process of measuring that? Or even how conscious ought we be about measuring it? I had always tried to live as a student and as a teacher and as an administrator in some way in a deep consciousness of the call to be faithful, and always live being terribly prodded by that verse that we've heard a number of times, to take up the cross daily, to learn to deny oneself and follow Jesus. And so I found myself merely having something made more powerful in this struggle between success and discipleship in a new kind of way. And I suppose it was because it was new to me. that I was having difficulty coming to terms with it, and it probably became a bigger issue for me than maybe it is for a lot of parish pastors. Maybe they've resolved all of that. I'm not sure. Then there were some other dimensions to what I would refer to this identity quest. Not an identity crisis. Please, let's not exalt it to those proportions. There was, you know, nothing. I didn't have to spend any money for psychiatrists or go to fellow pastors or anybody. Lutheran Social Service got by scot-free. All of that. There was never that kind of thing. It was merely that this stuff was being dealt with at a reflective level for me, and it was kind of a joyful and creative nasty struggle. I guess that'd be the way to describe it. But I saw other problems in this matter of the identity quest that probably affected other parish pastors, I had the feeling, more than it did me. One was the pressure to be continually educated. And I saw that this had a reverse side of always saying either that I was uneducated or that my fellow pastors were uneducated or that they were very inadequate. And for those of you who are going out into parish ministry, you just wait until you see your mail. Our intern, one of the things I did quite frequently, I said, fine, I'll take out my personal mail, you go through all that other stuff. Have that joyful experience. Getting all of those mailings about all of the people that are sponsoring institutes and seminars and weekends and overnights. I tell you, you can go to Israel, you can go to Africa, you can find four or five of them in St. Cloud. They've got four or five going on probably at Luther Seminary, at Wartburg, at St. Olaf. They want to be sure that we parish pastors have an adequate opportunity to be continually educated. I tried to read all that stuff, and I tried to keep, you know, some files on that stuff until I began to recognize the envelopes. Now, I don't mean to poo-poo all of that. That isn't the point. But somehow I found people saying to me in a direct, indirect way that as a parish pastor, I should know about legal problems as they relate to divorce. That I should know about social questions, about social agencies, that I needed to become a better communicator and they would help me, that I needed to be better in PR and they would help me, that I needed to be better in terms of finance and they would help me, that I needed to be a better administrator, that I needed to do better exegesis, that I needed to know more about ecology, that I needed to know more about worship. Now, you just go through a battery of that, you know, constantly, and gee, you begin to wonder, is there any of this stuff that I could do well at all? And add to that the fact that you get a unified mailing from central offices, three of which are still on my desk unopened. But I had to learn also how to live without some of those things. And what I observed in this process is that there was a complicated relationship between pastors and their fellow professionals. Everyone seemed to be out to teach pastors. Now, having been in academia, I also knew that there was a very definite correlation between developing these programs for pastors and keeping various jobs available at some educational institutions. You know, there was some very, I sat in and helped plan some of those programs when I was at St. John's. It did not reflect always, the fact that there are such enormous needs, but there were some needs within the institution that were also being met. But everybody, it seemed, wanted to teach me now that I'd become a parish pastor. But when I looked around me, and I never once heard of the fact that the local medical society was calling on the parish pastor because he was some kind of expert who could really help them in some of their bedside manners or how to relate to patients as they were dying. I never heard that the lawyers were getting together and calling on the clergy to help them be sensitive and compassionate in dealing with divorce cases. The local social workers, they certainly didn't call on the pastors. to, you know, learn how they related to families and their problems of crises. You know, as a matter of fact, I didn't discover any place where any of those people ever really asked pastors, you know, to be the resident experts for their continuing education. I didn't even discover, though it does happen now, that there's much more exchange with the seminary at this level. There's some high and very fine things going on, and have gone on for some time. But that isn't always the case either. You know, it would be interesting. Wouldn't it be fun? I've even toyed with it, of 10 pastors getting together and establishing an institute. The admission price is $150. It's prepared especially for seminary professors. Sponsor. Come and use your continuing education funds to sit at our feet. Wouldn't it be interesting to do that? See what would happen. I toyed about that. And then, you know, another thing that happened is that I saw that I got any number of invitations to give talks, to be on boards and so on, some strange kinds of things. And then I reflected on those. Why did I get those? And I had to come to the conclusion that almost never because I was a parish pastor, but because I had a PhD. That was, then it, you know, that kind of got to me. I must tell you that. It did bother me a lot. Then one day I remember going to the hospital. Any medical doctors here? Fine, it's too bad. I remember going to the hospital, and I began to reflect about, you know, my ministry now at this particular place, and I became very much aware that I was on alien territory, that this territory belonged to them. And I remember going through the door, and I thought, isn't it interesting? And I guess part of it was that I was probably a little bit angry from the week before, when a doctor had related to a patient, had told her news that was absolutely devastating, walked out of the room immediately after telling her, and was with her for 5 minutes, and I came in immediately afterward to find her shattered and in tears, and spent 45 minutes trying to recover the losses. And then I began to reflect as I went into this alien territory this day, I started to reflect on this set of professionals is over against myself. And first of all, I came to the conclusion that I had more years of formal institutional education than they. And then I began to reflect on our relative financial worth. As I went through there and spent 45 minutes or 2 hours on a given day, I began to come to that interesting conclusion that I was worth probably 1/5 to 1/15 as much in terms of per hourly value. I got guts enough one day to mention this to a friend, a psychiatrist, and the complications of this relationship, and he said, I can understand what you mean, because he was a very active Baptist layman. He said, you know, when we didn't have a pastor for a while, he said, I went to the hospital and visited as a layperson, not as Dr. So-and-so. And he said the difference was shocking. The relationship to other professionals I find to be sometimes very, very complicated. Sometimes in relating to the medical profession, I find myself doing funny things. If I want to be very sure that I get through an office, I call up and say, Dr. Icor is calling for Dr. So-and-so. And I get through like nothing. But only on one instance did I ever, I guess, really discover that something was said to me, with the exception of now recently, where one of them is a beloved part of our parish, telling me that, you know, my ministry was terribly important and very, very much needed. And I know even one day, calling after having been so yelled at, experienced all the anger and hostility of a woman in our parish who had cancer, that he called me to talk about her, but I know he didn't call me to talk about her at all. He called me only because he was so shattered he didn't know what to do, and he simply wanted to talk to somebody who might be compassionate in understanding this woman. That's a complicated thing, I think, for pastors. Then there were in this identity quest some surprise factors. One of the kind of surprise factors was what I would call an anti-clericalism among pastors. It took strange kinds of forms. It seemed to be maybe the result of this kind of intimidation process. Intimidation by other professionals, intimidation by those who are always in need of being further educated, in need of knowing so much and you can never know it. Fascination that other people certainly must be doing more exciting things, more important things, and I'm just a pastor. I had picked this up when I was a layperson, because I remember Lutheran, Catholic, Baptist, pastors, Methodist who had come to me. They came to me rather than going to one of their fellow clergymen or their bishop or their superintendent or whatever, because I had absolutely no ecclesiastical authority in relation to their lives. And they would talk then, you know, I think at times they were looking at my particular profession as one of the ways out. And I think probably most of those sessions were rather, there was, I hope, an adequate degree of love and compassion. But the form that they took very frequently was rather significant confrontation about whether or not the grass was greener on the other side of the fence. There is a peculiar kind of fascination at times, I think, with pastors about greener grass, and almost a little moaning and groaning because there are not many different companies that we can go to work for, you know. If you're ALC, you might squeeze into the LCA. If you want to, you might squeeze into the Missouri Synod, whatever. But you see, you know, you don't move from IBM to Control Data and, you know, Minnesota Mining and so on. There isn't that latitude within the vocation itself in some respects. But I always began to talk about that grass on the other side of the fence because I was on the other side of the fence. And I tried to indicate that very frequently the grass was brown, it dried up too, there was a lot of tedium and so on. Another thing that I saw in this anti-clericalism was a peculiar exaltation of the laity. It used to irritate me because I was a layperson and, you know, I don't really kind of want to do some of those pastoral things, and after all the lay people, there's nothing that I can do as a pastor that lay people can't do better almost. And I saw lay people wanting their pastor to, you know, exercise what I would call a stronger kind of pastoral leadership. You know, to be even at times more confrontative or whatever. But there was always this backing down. And a part of it is that struggle that has gone on, it seems to me, between an authoritarian style of pastoral ministry, of which there are very few still in existence, I think, and what is referred to as an enabling style of pastoral ministry. And I can't even decide who's worse, an extreme authoritarian or an extreme enabler. It is unreal, because sometimes the most authoritarian people I have confronted have been those extreme enablers. It's just that all of the manipulation that's going to occur is so subtle and has to be, I have to voice all of my cooperation before it can take place, and then it will take place almost with a vengeance. And there are ways that I wish I could tell you about that exaltation of the laity. I sensed it on a board one time where, you know, they were, and I sense it every time I go to church convention. Can't decide whether or not we ought to increase the representation of the laity. And there's something that's subtly residing about this, as though there is no sense that I, as the pastor of Atonement Lutheran Church, I must be so different from those lay people that I can't possibly represent their interests. I have to tell you with all candor, I find to be just pure and utter nonsense. We can talk about that perhaps later, but it's important to bring in. Now, what is the theological response or the theological word to this kind of quest? It has to be, and it has to be continually, that I have to have an affirmation for my work, my occupation, my profession. And that affirmation has to, in its most profound, in its deepest, in its most persistent sense, has to be theological from God. I am not a pastor living to please men, even though I am living to serve human beings. See, I think we preach this affirmation that God accepts us and loves us, but that has to be related to me in terms of my work. I am working also to be pleasing to God. It is affirmed. I think there is some greater difficulty in my life at this point, to some degree, because of the closeness of my vocation, which is to be a Christian disciple, and my occupation as a pastor. Because it's so hard to sort those things out. Maybe I could illustrate this. If I would be a school teacher, there would be a system apart from any theological relationships at all that would be a human system of affirmation that was very well accepted. You know, there would be lanes that I would move up in, merit, all kinds of things that had no correlation between anything theological. But I can't sort those out so quickly. It's more difficult in parish ministry. And it's also made very difficult because I live in a culture that is so engaged in human affirmation. I sense it going on in the Holden Village theology. Human affirmation is the lifestyle of the day. We are running around, sometimes in a frenzy, trying to tell other people that they're okay, that we accept them, that we love them. We have had so much instant love in the last few years, it is astonishing. I experienced much of that stuff that's hit the Lutheran Church with the Catholics a long time ago. I was at the Second Vatican Council and really was in on that stuff, no more about some of that stuff than about Lutherans. And, you know, that instant going to weekends of being sure we can be open to one another, totally open to one another, and take off our clothes in front of one another, almost, and be so sure that we instantly love one another. You know, I'll kid you not, I was one time in a place where a married guy was trying to make out with another married woman, and he was telling her how much he needed her affirmation. Don't ask me any questions about that. But don't draw any inferences that I was in any sense in a situation that you would. It happened so totally unexpectedly. I still shudder when I think of it. Now, it is hard to distinguish some of the things that are going on in terms of evaluations of what we do. You know, and we are very much caught up in, I think, something that is important about evaluating our parish ministry, evaluating the effectiveness of our work. But we have to really be careful at what level we are just seeking a kind of human affirmation, and when we are really engaged in the process of discipleship. When is it that God is calling us to tasks that will not win us human affirmation? I'll tell you, Thursday night, maybe when I talk about the abortion question, there is some human affirmation in the American Lutheran Church that I did not gain by some of the things that I have said in confronting certain leaders in the church on that issue. And I suppose in some respects it could have some influence on future calls. But to that, one has to sometimes say, so what? In the midst of this I'm okay, you're okay cult, I like what William Sloan Coffin, former chaplain at Yale University, said, as quoted by Henry Nouwen. He said the Christian doesn't worry about that very much. It's not Christian to say, I'm okay, you're okay. Christian thing to say is, I'm not okay, you're not okay, but Jesus says that's okay. Or maybe it would be more Christian to say that Jesus makes us okay. That's so much for that kind of identity quest. Now let's talk about something, a different kind of dimension, the breadth and variety of parish ministry, its privileges. I have to tell you something very honestly by way of confession. I love parish ministry. I really have found it exciting. I feel now, you know, kind of defensive on behalf of fellow pastors and want to take and hold them up and do all sorts of things. Found it tremendously challenging. Very joyful experience, not without significant suffering at times. But I also want to hasten to say, but it is not the case, as one friend wrote to me on the occasion of my ordination, and beloved Wendell gave the ordination sermon out there in Washburn, North Dakota. It is not now the case that I just entered into full-time service of the Lord. I have a view of ministry that really I was quite convinced that as a college teacher and in doing administration, I existed very much in the full-time service of the Lord. That was a different kind of thing. But I have to make some comparisons here that in no sense are intended as put-downs. I have to compare it to, say, the work of a college teacher. By contrast, I think I would say that, and I used to say this to pastors that came to me when looking for greener grass, that as a college teacher, I saw that there were really fundamentally, in order to kind of make it and work out in some acceptable way my vocation in my occupation, if I did not make it in the classroom, it was pretty hard to make it, particularly in undergraduate teaching. But if I didn't make it in the classroom, if I could, you know, could be a fairly lousy teacher, but still, you know, a decent human being, there'd be still another opportunity. I could make it in administration. You know, and that can be, you can even do that without being a department head. It's not the most lovely place to be in the world at times. Particularly if it's better than it used to be. Between 1966 and 1972, middle management in academic institutions could have never been paid enough. There's no salary that they could have commanded in some of those positions that would have been adequate to the task. But if one didn't make it there, there would be still the possibility that in one-to-one relationships with students, you could find an awful lot of satisfaction, work out your vocation in peculiar ways. But then if one didn't make it there, in a few institutions, one could make it in research and writing. But I really didn't, as I've been able to analyze it, there aren't too many more possibilities. Now, if I were to compare that to parish ministry, it seems that the number of opportunities to work out one's ministry are much broader. There are far greater potentiality. First of all, you can make it as a preacher. There are many people that really are relatively lousy in almost anything else they do, but make it as preachers. If one can't make it very well as a preacher, there are good parish managers, people who do it in terms of administration. Make it as an administrator and do a lot of other things pretty badly. Or if you can't do those, you could do crisis ministry very well. Sometimes you can make it on the basis of ministering to people who are sick, going through enormous crisis, or those who are bereaved. If you can't make it there, you could make it just on the basis of ministering very effectively to youth. Some congregations, you could make it on the basis of ministering very effectively to the elderly. And you can put these together, among other things, into a whole range of combinations. And you know, there are some people that just make it on the basis of their kind of, they make it on the basis of their personal quality, on their one-to-one relationships, and exercise rather effective ministry. Because they can meet people and are very, very open to people, and a lot of things begin to happen. I'm really impressed with the diverse possibility. Now, I'm a little bit depressed at times by the enormity of the demands that come through those possibilities. Another thing that really impresses me by contrast to college teaching is the ministry to people of all ages, at all stages and conditions in life. I really liked working with people where I was primarily between the ages of 18 and 25. Occasionally there'd be somebody 60, 65. I used to add a lot to the class. I can remember one beautiful class I had in a summer school teaching New Testament. Probably had a couple Lutherans, had 19 women teachers between the ages of 19 and 69. And I never will forget Winnie Graham, the last day of class when I told a joke in response to a question that some student asked about what I thought about the person who had been taking pictures of spirits coming out of a grave. And then I told a joke that was even, you know, just a little bit ambiguous in terms of whether it was appropriate. And there was one very pious lady who was trying to hold her lips, keeping them tight, and Winnie, who was 69, she had to laugh so bad she slapped her knee, and it was a trick knee and it went out. They had to carry her home to her apartment, and I had to give her her final exam orally at home. But that was quite a rare experience in terms of college. But you know, it is so much to minister to people, to literally minister before birth to the grave, and all of those human stages and conditions in between, is quite an exciting challenge. I even helped write a paper about the office of bishop that we are now contemplating. We're going to elect a new one in southwestern Minnesota. I discovered in our theology in the American Lutheran Church, there's no expectation that the bishop exercise any of his powers of ordination. He's been ordained to a ministry of word and sacrament, but he has no place where he can exercise that matter of sacrament. He has no rightful place, no rightful calling to baptize children. I thought, boy, you know, one of the biggest thrills for me as a parish pastor is to be involved in baptizing children. And we do it up. The first baptism I ever had, though I still wasn't ordained, and Wendell had to come with all his ordained power and do the actual rite, the actual action of baptism. See, that's something we share. You don't forget that, do you? I think, as a matter of fact, that family now, Wendell is there, he's the president of the congregation. Some fantastic power that you had there. But that is important. The other thing that I have sensed to be significantly different is what I would call the level of immediate gratification. It's something that I sense, no offense to those of you who are students, but I wonder if the present student generation as a whole has as much ability to defer gratification as a previous generation did. Do you know, to go through school and be working towards something that's many, many years down the way, that's a lot of deferred gratification. You have to live on that in view of what is going to ultimately be one's reward. The same is true many times as a college professor, because you will go about that teaching task striving to be faithful, but the results of it, you know, you can feel you've done your task, you've delivered the material, done a good job. It's going to be a long time until there are many of those future gratifications. Wendell sees it now. I hope he is at least reasonably pleased with his former student. And, you know, now I can bring to him some gratification. But much of that had to be deferred. There's an awful lot of deferred gratification in my previous existence. I didn't know what to do with all that immediate gratification. You know, never will forget how it was expressed. You know, we came, had been ordained, and were installed in. Our kids were called out, and the parish gave them some little gift. My goodness, we'd moved all over the country. Nobody ever took note of the fact that we came in some of those instances. Suddenly here, all kinds of people loved us. We hadn't done a thing. I didn't know what to do with all that. And then, you know, the matter of doing a particular task. Have you ever visited someone who is elderly, and they don't see many people in any given week or month? You come and they are so thrilled and happy. You could say anything. You speak German, all he knows Norwegian, and they'd be happy. That's something of what I mean. So many things like that where the gratification is so much closer to the action itself. Well, that doesn't mean one ought to get faked out about comments after sermons. You know, but nonetheless, there's a very large dimension there that I. There's a deceptive dimension too. One can start to live for that and live off of that in a bad way. But man, you know, you could just preach a lousy sermon, have a lousy week, and then you know very well if you want to get lifted up a little bit, go see Tilly. And she'll just be thrilled and beaming, you know. There are three Norwegian ladies in our congregation who very frequently are together. And I give them such a bad time about being Norwegian. You know, they refer to me as the German Shepherd. But I love them too. Another thing that I have discovered as a surprising privilege of pastoral ministry and an awesome kind of responsibility is the right to intervene in other people's lives. Have you ever known a doctor who discovers that one of his patients is sick, but they won't come to him, you know? They're withering away at home, but he says, I'm the doctor. It's my responsibility to go visit them and see that they get, you know, try to see if I can offer my services. How many of you have ever heard of that happening? How many have you? That's rare. Must have been your father. But, you know, or the counselor, you know, who knows that such and such out there, you know, marriage is falling apart. He's totally aware of it because friends have told him. The counselor says, makes his call, says, I want to help you. I don't know of anybody that can do that. But there's a strange thing that happens by virtue of the church being a community where people have covenanted together, even in minimal ways, that gives a pastor a kind of right to intervene. You sense it, for example, in families where alcoholism is, you know, known for people to be a problem. I can hear something going on, and because they know that I'm not going to be, you know, just coming out there so that I can do surgery for $500, but that I'm, you know, I haven't got much self-interest in one sense that's so very visible. That it's not going to be assumed that I'm there, but for any reason, because I'm concerned about their well-being. That is one of the most enormous professional privileges that exists for the clergy, that exists for no other group that I know of in society. I also think something of which clergy, by and large, do not adequately use. It's an astonishing thing. And the enormous amount of goodwill on the part of lay people that is present. Well, so much. There, much more could be said. Let me get to the final little section and time goes. I'm so windy. These are special and problematical aspects. First of all, I find the parish to be just terribly hard and relentless work. Relentless. One of the more difficult kinds of adjustments as compared to previous existence was the inability or the loss of freedom in controlling my schedule. Losing those blocks of time that I could take out. You know, nobody was asking me what I was going to be doing on such and such a night, because in one sense it was none of their business. But now, The kinds of needs, you know, I don't have to deal with an enormous number of emergencies, but I have found that people get very ill at the most inconvenient times, and I wish they would arrange their dying different. Just after the most impossible week, sometimes after, I remember one occasion, after 10 nights straight of work, killing kind of work, major effort in the parish, got to bed, and 4 o'clock in the morning, that's the morning the phone went. That's the morning, you know, of tragedy. And to live and survive that relentless kind of work is tough. It's made, the work of the parish is made difficult for another several reasons. It takes an enormous amount of initiative. If one lets everything else be the initiating force, then you're going to lose control of your lives entirely. If you wait for everybody else to start the activity, then you become only a reactor. You'll never be a Holden Village. You have to be a self-starter. And I guess, you know, all those years in graduate school and stuff, but I wasn't such a slow learner. Being a self-starter, that's one thing that I found to be terribly helpful in parish ministry. But you have to be a tremendous self-stopper. Or you see all kinds of people that get wound up. Sorry, any of you who come to me and brag about never taking your day off, you go brag to somebody else. I haven't got one bit of admiration for you. If you're such a chump, haven't learned that yet, you know, go stew in somebody else's that's got like juice. And I don't even talk about it in terms of a day off. Why is it that the rest of the society has got legitimately always thinking in terms of 2 days off a week? No, I think in different terms. Not because I'm lazy, not because I'm not interested in lacrosse, not because I'm not interested, it won't be inconvenienced, but because for the sake of service, I know something about myself at that point. Then there is another thing about this is that work is never done. I never can lay down my head at night and think, you know, that, well, might have gotten an enormous amount of work done for the day, but I can never feel that it's done. I haven't put in 8 hours and, you know, been able to walk away and leave. It's never done. And there is a strange propensity among those of us who are justified by grace to want to work very, very hard, too, to justify ourselves. I have a sneaking suspicion that that's being counteracted. I'm worried that there might be, and I also at times, and I sense it among clergy, there's also some laziness. That justification by works does not lead to good works. Man alive. We have to talk about good works that flow from that justification. We have to talk about obedience in terms of theology instead of just some of this, you know, big, cheap grace that God showers all over everybody. Point number two about special problematical aspects is the accountability. I will assert, I think in the face of most anyone, that there is a higher level of accountability in parish ministry than most any kind of work. One of the problems, however, is that it's very frequently not very explicit. One doesn't know on what standards or how one is sometimes being called into account. If I would be teaching at a state university, who is going to make me accountable for my work? The students? The department head? The dean? The administration? There are many, many levels before that stuff really gets through to me. They're multi-layered. The same is true, I'm on a school board, you know. You think I really know what those teachers do? You think I would dare trust the judgments of a lot of kids at certain points? You know, they're multi-layers. There's a union to protect them. Then there's an administration to protect them. Then there's a board to protect them, and so on and so on. You know what? I preach a sermon, and people exercise immediate judgment because at our church, the offering plates are passed right after the sermon. Some have suggested that it would be wise to pass them before. Accountability is that direct in so many, many ways. And one of the problems is to work out just ways so that that accountability can be explicit. We have done that in our parish, I think reasonably successful, as a result of previous administrative work. We have a personnel committee that functions unusually well. Because of so much direct accountability, I think many pastors are terribly gun-shy. I do not find a high level of courage among pastors in many levels, and I think this is one of the reasons why. Because you're there like a sitting duck. You're directly related to everybody. You haven't got, you know, we can't relate through layers. Directly related to everybody. The people that pay you, you know, you don't collect it through this tax structure. You have just nothing but direct relationships to them in a whole variety of ways. Enormous accountability. Thirdly, the relationships to members. I often wonder, do I really know them? And yet there are some things, obviously, that I know about people, and you as pastors know about people, that nobody else in the world, sometimes not even the spouse, knows about people. You know, tremendous amount of that. And yet there's an uneasiness. Do I know them? And do they dare really be my friends? That's been a little bit easier problem for me to deal with because I haven't had to face it so much because I have many previous friends by virtue of living in exactly the same house, exactly the same place that I did when I was a professor and now I'm a pastor. Then there's the problem of hypocrisy, and I'm going to address that problem differently than I've ever seen anybody else. I think hypocrisy is something that the world of the unbelievers is using to put down the church, accusing all of us who go to church as being gross hypocrites. And I don't see quite as much hypocrisy. I see something that I describe it as different. I call it eschatological behavior. I find that, and I'm even going to say that it's not such a bad thing. Many people behave in my presence in terms of what they want to be, in terms of what they wish they were, in terms of what they hope to become. And there's nothing so bad about that. I'll tell you something that's a lot worse. And that is all of those people who are so busy being what they are in terms of the old Adam. They have settled for being junk. And they have no eschatological vision of what God wants to do with them, so they're not at all in danger of hypocrisy.